Okay, so we're going to talk about the meaning or purpose of life. And I think from a biological point of view, it's pretty simple to break down. Survival and replication. Once we get that done, it's up to us. And we just sort of make it up as we go. So we have a bunch of religions that tell us what the meaning or purpose of life is. And from a Buddhist perspective, it's pretty easy to break down. The purpose of life is to end suffering, because humans suffer all the time, and they all suffer until they achieve nirvana. What we need to understand first is why we suffer, and then how to end that suffering. And the reason we suffer as humans, according to Buddhism, is because we have attachment and desire and craving, and we connect to the good stuff and push away the bad stuff. And because we can never see it in any kind of realistic way, we always fail. So it's a dilemma that humans have faced since the creation of self, that we are lucky to have a human self that separates us from the rest of the world and allows us to manipulate and use it to our advantage. Unfortunately, because we do have a separate self, and it makes us sometimes feel lonely or fearful because it's us against the world. So in Buddhism, what we say is this: there's a underlying anxiety because of the separation. And the practice of Buddhism allows us to reconnect to the world in a very special way. So I'm going to talk about six aspects of practice that Mahayana Buddhists do to realize their true nature. The first practice is called dana. Dana is generosity. It's one of the perfections. And what's interesting to me is the path starts with being generous. Being generous to others, being generous to yourself. It doesn't necessarily mean goods or items or money. It can simply mean sharing or giving time to someone who needs to speak or needs to be listened to. And in this giving, a special connection is created between the person and the person who is receiving. Now, I have found two ways that I practice giving that makes me feel good about myself and good about the world. The first practice of giving that I do is I feed cats. So I have 7 feral cats in the backyard of the meditation center. And we just got a new one today. So now we have 8 feral cats in the back of the meditation center. And when the first couple showed up, I wasn't sure exactly what to do, so I fed them. And in feeding them, they interpreted that as now they have a home, and now they don't leave. And so twice a day, I go into the backyard and I feed the cats. And it costs me about $150 a month to feed the cats. We have dry food out all the time. We have wet food morning and evening. So most of them are fat and fluffy now and happy with their surroundings. Now, one of the interesting parts about feeding cats is they never say thank you. That they simply accept the food and then they walk away. And so there's a certain level of equanimity that's necessary to feed animals, because animals aren't going to be like humans and say thank you, hopefully. Or, you know, it's so nice of you to be concerned and kind with me. They just simply eat and go. We also have koi fish, and koi fish don't even come and go. They just stay in the pond, and I feed them, and I found that feeding them is even a more interesting task, because they don't breathe or exist in the way I do. They're in the water, and they have gills, and so it's like a whole different creature that I'm feeding. And then I used to feed birds in the backyard, but then the cats would hang around the bird feeder. And that wasn't such a good idea. So I stopped feeding the birds, but somebody else is feeding the birds. Somebody asked me the other day as I'm buying cat food, wouldn't it be better to feed humans than to feed cats? And I said, well, there are plenty of people feeding humans, and there are plenty of people feeding cats, and there are plenty of people feeding dogs, and all together, everybody gets fed. So this practice of generosity has changed my life in the sense that I find that giving allows me to receive in many different ways. The next practice we want to do is morality. Morality is important because we all live together. We got people living behind us, in front of us, next to us. And morality turns out to be the foundation of Buddhist meditation. We have five aspects of morality that we focus on. The first one is not to kill. The second one is not to take what is not given. The third one is not to indulge in sexual misconduct. The fourth one is not to speak unskillfully. And the fifth one is not to become intoxicated. So it is a challenge, to say the least, to keep that kind of clarity and enthusiasm necessary to hold these precepts. We don't say they're commandments. These are training precepts. I'm training myself to live in the world in a specific way. What we find is that there is no divine lawgiver who will punish us if we don't hold the precepts, but there is something called karma, the cause and consequence of what we think, say, and do. If anybody watched the news yesterday, they saw Charlie Sheen talking about his karma and his consequence. Now, however you look at what he did as being skillful or unskillful, it seems that there is a consequence to someone who is not disciplined. And the disciplined activity of speech, action, and mind allows a Buddhist to have a particular perspective about things. And that perspective is that I am in charge of my life in a very specific way. I can make my life better, I can make my life worse, depending on what I think, say, and do. Now, there are a lot of people that have a really good life, and I think you've probably seen them. They've been in sports, they've been in music, they've been in big business, and they've created a really good life for themselves. The ironic thing for me is sometimes these people with a really good life want to make their life more exciting because they simply have a good life and not an exciting life. So they add this little bit of excitement into their life and it ruins it. It changes it completely. Someone who's been a successful businessman and has a business and has a family might decide to go to Las Vegas and make his life more interesting by gambling. Now, gambling can be a very expensive hobby. It can take all your money in one day. Everything you've worked and hope to have can be taken away from you because of this delusion and this greed. So to have a good life and to have an exciting life sometimes can go together. But some people would prefer to have exciting over good, and I think that's when they suffer more rather than suffer less. So these five precepts allow us to look at them as a reference point. Should I do this? Should I say this? Am I skillful in thinking this way? Or will this lead me to suffer more rather than suffer less? Now the fifth one I thought was interesting. It's not to become intoxicated. And I have to thank Bernadette, your teacher. She gave me a gift. She gave me a six-pack of beer. And I said, Bernadette, I don't know if this is really an appropriate gift, but thank you for giving it to me. And what I have been doing, now the reason she gave it to me is because each bottle is shaped like a Buddha. And this is called Enlightenment Beer from China. So I appreciate the thought. And in drinking it, I don't know if I would have become enlightened or not.
After the sixth.
Probably not. And so what I've done is I've given bottles away to people as a gift. So Bernadette allowed me to give six gifts away to people. I said, look at this wonderful Buddha bottle here. I'm not encouraging you to drink the beer, but I am encouraging you to use it as a flower holder. You can put a little water in there and have a little flower, and the Buddha will be smiling at you every day. So whether they drank it or not, I'm not sure, but I bet it's going to make a wonderful adornment in their place of in business or at home. In looking at what we're trying to do as a Buddhist, we're trying to come to a place of skillful living where we have reduced our suffering as much as possible. The third practice we can do is the practice of patience. This is a very difficult practice, especially in Los Angeles. If you've ever driven on the 405 freeway at any time, day or night, you realize there's about 10,000 people out there with you, and most of them are distracted by their cell phones, or they're combing their hair, or a variety of other things, and they're not paying attention to what they're doing. And so it's stop and go, it's stop and go. When the other cars go, they don't, because they're involved in talking and texting and having all sorts of wonderful conversations on the freeway. And as I get older, I find it's getting harder and harder just to drive, let alone to also talk, let alone to also text, let alone to also do anything else. So I'm there driving, and I'm practicing my patience. And the first thing I do in my patient practice is I forgive everybody for being a jerk. And they're all out there, and they're to my left, and they're to my right, and they're behind me, and they're in front of me, and they're all jerks, and they're not paying attention as well as they should, and I forgive them, which allows me to relax and feel a bit more comfortable with them. Then I practice patience. What I'm doing is I realize everything has a time. Everything has a time limit, and everything that's created will be destroyed or will have to end. So I realize that this temporary place on the freeway is subject to change at any moment, and what I need to do is be patient enough to allow the change to occur. And if I try to push the change, or if I wish the change would happen faster than it is, what happens to me? I suffer more. I feel more uncomfortable rather than less. And so I practice patience. If I practice my forgiveness and I practice my patience, then what happens miraculously is I find myself in a moment of acceptance. I'm sitting there on the freeway with the 10,000 other people who don't know how to drive, and all of a sudden, I see that everything is perfect and just the way it's supposed to be. And the problem with me is I can't see the perfection. I know how it could be. I know how it should be. I don't know how it is until I come to this place of acceptance. The fourth practice is to generate spiritual energy. Oh, this can be really difficult because sometimes spirituality is boring. I have sat on cushions on the floor for hours at a time, sometimes weekends. And it's been so difficult because nobody's talking, nobody's singing. There's just silence and sitting. Weeks, months seem to go by in an hour or half hour. And sometimes the energy just dissipates and you want to just fall down and go to sleep until it's over. Spiritual energy is necessary because there's all sorts of roadblocks to our perfection, to our enlightenment, to the end of our suffering. And we need to keep resurrecting the energy necessary to take the next step and the next step and the next step. It requires us to get enough sleep. It requires us to have enough food for the energy because the food becomes medicine in our spiritual practice. It requires us not to start and stop and start and stop. It requires us to have a steady, methodical movement forward. Even if you're tired, even if you know the next step is going to be the worst step, you still take it. What you start to understand on your spiritual journey is there's no place to rest and there's no place to stop. You can't go back. You can't stay where you are. You have to go forward. And there are many times when you don't want to go forward because you see the abyss in front and you know you'll be falling into it sooner or later and you don't want to go there. And yet there is no option. So this energy is necessary for forward momentum in your spiritual practice. We come to meditation. Meditation is when we change our minds about stuff. Our minds are filled with the three poisons, the Buddha said. Our minds are filled with greed, hatred, and delusion. And what we need to do in our meditation practice is we need to transform the greed into generosity, which is the first practice I talked about. We need to transform our hatred and our anger into kindness and love. And we need to transform our delusion and ignorance into wisdom and insight. We need the wisdom and insight necessary to make the correct choices in our life. We only get one chance to make a choice, and it's always the first time. And we never know what the outcome is going to be. But if we have clarity, there's a better chance of making the right choice and suffering less. 44 different kinds of meditation in Buddhism. We have 4 kinds of insight meditation. We have 40 kinds of tranquility meditation. And in practicing tranquility and insight, what we find are kindness and clarity. The Buddha was taught how to do the tranquility meditation by the yogis of India. But he realized in doing tranquility meditation, it was a temporary fix, not one that stayed there for the remainder of his life. That while he was meditating, while he was focused on his object of meditation, he no longer suffered. But as soon as he got up off his cushion and went out into the world, suffering came back. And he said, I bet there's a way to make this permanent. And he rediscovered a path of meditation that had been lost to the world, but had been practiced by the 27 Buddhas before him. We feel he's the 28th Buddha. And that is called Vipassana. That is called insight meditation. And this leads to a permanent release of suffering. This leads to nirvana. This leads to the end of suffering, the end of karma, and the end of all future rebirth. Now, that may not sound like a big deal, but if you were living in Syria right now and you wanted to end your suffering, there's nothing out there that's going to do it for you. So if there was a Buddhist out there saying, hey, listen, I can help you end your suffering by sharing with you how I ended my suffering, I bet you get a lot of people listening and a lot of people curious about that. So you see, Buddhism has one specific message, and that is why we suffer and how to end that suffering. Now we come to the last part of this 6-part evolution, spiritual evolution in Buddhism. It's called wisdom. What is the wisdom of Buddhism in this particular model? This is a Mahayana model. As you all know, if you've studied Buddhism, there are 3 kinds of Buddhism in the world: Theravada, doctrine of the elders, orthodox approach, Indian Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, the Protestants, the Reform Movement. This is practiced in China and Korea and Vietnam and Japan. Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle. This is Tibetan Buddhism. When Mahayana Buddhism finally went over the Himalayas in around the 5th or 6th century, it fused with the Bon religion, and we had Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana. This comes out of the second vehicle, the Mahayana vehicle. The wisdom of emptiness. The wisdom of emptiness. This is a very difficult concept for humans to understand. The wisdom of emptiness is this: we do not exist independently. We are conditional creatures. We exist because of 10,000 conditions. Some of them are clothing and food and water and air and shelter and medicine, and the list goes on and on and on. Those are the conditions necessary for us to live. We are always interconnected with them. We can't get apart from them. It won't happen. So what the Buddha said is this: the true nature, the ultimate reality, is that you do not exist independently. You are interconnected and interdependent with all phenomena. When this is experienced, and we call this experience the enlightenment experience, when this is experienced, when you realize that you are really, ultimately interconnected and interdependent and never live separately from those causal conditions, there is a wonderful transformation of heart. What you find is your heart breaks never to mend again. That there's a certain level of sadness that will follow you through the rest of your life. And if you look at very wise people, in pictures or in person, what you find in their eyes is a certain level of sadness. Because they have come to the realization that if one person is hungry, there is a part of them that is hungry. If one person is homeless, there is a part of them that is homeless. If one person is dying in a hospice, there is a part of them that is dying in the hospice. They understand through the personal experience of enlightenment that they are always interconnected and interdependent, and their only response to the world now is one of service. That they see in others themselves. They see the suffering in others as suffering in themselves. And they will be of service, and they will help not to make the person's life better, but to reduce their suffering. So for a Buddhist, it's not about making the world a better place. It's about reducing and ultimately ending the suffering that's already there. And we have 7 billion people right now who are suffering, some more and some less. And as the decades and centuries unravel, we're going to have 8 billion, we're going to have 9 billion, we're going to have issues with water and food and climate and air. And it never gets better. It only gets worse. And then one day the sun will burn out, and this place will no longer exist, and all the graves that were dug into this planet Earth will dissolve back into the universe to start all over again. In Buddhism, we say there isn't a first cause. We've always been here and always will be here. We're just simply in a constant state of transformation, impermanence, and part of our suffering is caused by that transformation or impermanence, because the good stuff never stays long enough and the bad stuff stays far too long. So everything's always changing. Yes?
You say that we've always been here, but if you dig up, like, you, there's a certain point where you would stop finding human bodies. So what would you think about that?
Well, when I say we've always been here, we've always been here in some form or another. They say in science you can't create energy or destroy energy. And right now we are breathing some of the same molecules that were found in Napoleon's body. So we really never, ever go away. We're just simply in a process of transformation all the time. From air to water to heat to solidity, our body comes together and our body comes apart over and over and over again. Fascinating. And so the mountains exist for 10,000 or 20,000 years and they turn to sand. And the trees exist for 300 or 400 years and they turn into splinters. And other trees take their place, and other mountains arise, and the lava flows continue. And some form of life has always been here, not us, but some form of life, and it will continue in other galaxies and throughout the cosmos. It's just this unfolding, fascinating way of looking at the world. So we're here in a very temporary way. We have the chance, and perhaps even the obligation to be of service to those who are here, so the ones who have yet to come will find it perhaps better, but at least the same. And we continue. So Buddhism is about why we suffer. Buddhism is about how to end suffering. The purpose of Buddhism is to end suffering in the world. The purpose of Buddhism is to end suffering in the world. And when you can become a Buddhist monk or nun, your lifestyle becomes an example of reduced suffering, except on the 405. And then you just suffer as much as everybody else. So thank you. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask before the next speaker speaks?
I do.
Yes?
So about a week ago, I was driving with my daughter, and I saw out of the corner of my eye this fluffy little cat on the side of the road. And we pulled over, mostly because she begged me to, and it was a beautiful cat with no collar. And I was very torn That means I probably wasn't that torn. And I decided I'm not taking that cat. But according to this doctrine, taking the cat would have been to practice, to fulfill the practice of generosity. Can you expand on that a little more?
Well, I'd say also kindness and compassion as well. Yeah. Because the little cat was suffering. And if you had taken the cat, your daughter would have probably been happy about it.
Yes.
Because somehow children and animals are connected in a much deeper way than adults and animals. Because we've, over the period of time, have eaten so many animals that have been killed for us that we lose the connection. So it's first of all, it would be a practice of generosity by stopping and saying, maybe I can help, even if it's going to take more time, and maybe even some money, maybe I can help. Maybe I can find it a home. Maybe I can get it fixed so it won't have any more cats itself. Maybe I can get it have a flea bath so it won't suffer from the fleas and keep scratching. But the idea of also understanding how kindness works, that here this kindness is the idea, and it's not love, it's mm-hmm. kindness, and it's reducing the suffering of the cat. And so do you have the time to do that? Could you have done it? And the probability is maybe I could have done it, but not everybody would even pull over.
Is kindness a muscle that grows when you exercise it? Are you more inclined to acts of kindness after you've done one like that?
I don't know if it's a realization as opposed, and it probably doesn't get better. The kindness that happens in Buddhism comes out of the intention of love, you know. And so the intention of love, which most people have for a lot of things, their cars, their shoes, their boyfriends, their girlfriends, favorite TV show. Oh, I love that TV show. Buddhism would look at that as the intention, and the activity of love would be considered kindness. So first we have to have the intention, which may come through a meditation practice. Then it might manifest in activity, and that activity of kindness is there to reduce suffering. And so it's not something that generally happens by itself, though there are certain people who seem to be kind all the time. It seems to require practice.
I shouldn't have taken the cat. Well, I learned something.
Now I've created some kind of remorse, you know, and you're going to have to live with that for a while.
Is that the Catholic part of you?
That's the Catholic part. But now when the next cat appears,
you
might have a different response.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely.
And there will always be a next cat.
Yeah.
True.
Thank you. Let's have the next speaker.